I'm going to move that we...
I really do think it's a three-part conversation. Risk diversified or FFP, once you're on to, if you want to do FFP, pick the reserve.
So I'm going to move that we adopt the FFP asset allocation strategy as a matter of policy.
I'll second it.
We probably don't need a formal motion until we get to the actual selection of an individual column here.
Well, there was some suggestion to be separated.
That's good.
Okay.
I think we should separate it.
Gordon, tell us.
Discussion. We have a motion and a second. Seeing no discussion, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed or abstained?
I'll move that we adopt in the FFP asset allocation strategy a four-year unconstrained strategy.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
And discussion. Just between a 3 and 4 year, what are the advantage, disadvantage differences? I'm leaning between those two.
3 years is probably a middle ground. 4 years, you've bought a lot of protection. And you have, so the consideration for the board is 4 years is probably, Ed and I probably differ on this, but I'd say 4 years would be all the protection you would need and then a bit. So is that your neutral position or do you want to go out to that? That would be kind of the feedback there.
Ed?
Are we in discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
You know, I like the idea, but there's a lot more risk than I'm ready to accept. And if we go to 24, we go to peer and headline risk. All of the FFP unrestraints are it's marked high as a risk. So I'm not ready to accept that one. I'm leaning more to FFP 4 year, the
Constrained.
Constrained, excuse me.
And the primary reason for that? I'm sorry, just to...
Well, the risk factor is not as high. The peer and headline risk is not as high. It's medium, and there's just...
Neither is the expected return.
Jerry, one real quick thing, just in the difference between those two that I'm really noticing is, just at the expected return, like Jerry is saying, Holcomb, the expected return is higher. However, the chance of meeting the 7.25% is much higher in the unconstrained.
Yeah, it is.
And peer and headline risk, I just want to cover, isn't that our response to peer and headline risk?
Well, that's not dollar and cents.
Right. How different do you look from your peers? Now,
right.
Barris has asked you several different ways, you know, how important it is for you to be in the pack, and you said that's a relatively low level priority for this organization.
So,
but you know, we again want to put that front and center. If you adopt, you know, one of the unconstrained portfolios, yeah, we're going to look significantly different from the pack. Mm-hmm. We have good reason to, but just understand that taking that difference is going to, we're going to be a little bit further out. Is the board comfortable with that?
So,
Herbie? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no, it's okay. Just to Jerry tell us this point is, what's the difference between medium and high? I know those are two different colors and two different words, but I mean, are we talking like are we talking like 89.9 and 90?
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, what's the distinguishing factor?
These are heuristics. Yeah. These are a gut feel on what medium and high is.
Yeah.
Okay. This is, although it's presented via Excel, there's no Excel math going into.
Okay, I was wondering if it was triggered on a conditional format or something like that.
I seconded the motion, and I still support the motion, but could you clarify to the extent you possibly could as to what portfolio complexity means to you and your folks, Tim?
Portfolio complexity is going to come down to probably front and center, or at least the initial indication would be how much are we doing in private markets. Private markets are by their very nature more complex. It requires more in-depth oversight. We're going to have to do additional underwriting of these deals either internally or via Verus or another specialty consultant.
Well, I have confidence in your ability to do it to some degree, but do you have the bandwidth to handle that additional complexity?
if the board wanted to pursue the FFP for unconstrained, we would have to go back and look at additional resources we need. There, we would come back to the board with a game plan of saying, to implement this effectively, these are the additional internal resources we need and the additional external resources we need.
Okay, thank you.
So does your first line of expected return, I mean, if we don't really know right now what that additional resources is that reasonable that 7.2%, or are we going to see, due to the high complexity, a higher cost, which might drive that lower?
I would argue it this way. We paid roughly $40 million in asset management fees last year. The additional resources we're talking about would be either internal staff or external consultants. Internal staff and external consultants last year were about 3% of that $40 million. If that 3% goes to 4%, 5%, or 6%, these are not meaningful impacts on the total here. These are relatively modest deployments of cash. I mean, to me, this is highly efficient use of our fee dollars, internal and consultants. And it's not going to be the big dollars. I mean, we're not going to see this move by $5, $10, $15, $20 million. We're going to see it move by $1 million, maybe.
Okay, and you believe that will be offset by savings of at least $1 million in fees, or additional return?
Additional return.
Harvey,
the line percent chance of meeting 7.25 is giving me a little bit of a pause in the actuarial context. Seems to me that when we have the conversation with Siegel about setting the assumed rate of return and they're looking at our numbers, they were very careful that we not drop below a 50% comfort level and probability of that. And I'm just sort of wondering whether putting a marker down that, in fact, I'm kind of surprised that our policy today is showing 42%, because I don't think that was the number that we discussed with the actuary, or that the actuary, from an actuarial standards of practice point of view, is comfortable saying that we can stay at 7.25, therefore.
Yeah. But isn't, so isn't I think their response going to be in that situation that you should consider reducing your assumed rate of return?
Yes, sir. Yes.
In fact,
yes, sir. Just so you understand the consequences of this conversation.
Right. That is changing, by the way.
I'm sorry?
What the actuary is going to respond, that there are some new Society of Actuary and Academy of Actuary pronouncements that are in the process or now out. Paul actually served on one of the committees that developed this, and it's tightening up rather dramatically what the actuary can do within the context of actuarial limitations on the client determines and you just use. They could very well come back and say, based on the new rules, which I have not spent any time looking at, but based on the new rules, you very much in your documentation indicate that this is what you're going to be able to earn, and we might allow 5% or 10% on either side of that, but you can't be beyond it.
I want to caution the board of not letting the tail wag the dog of trying to engineer a return mix that generates an actual rate of return. We need to engineer an asset mix that fulfills the core functions of this organization, then let Siegel come in and apply a valuation metric to that and apply their expertise on what they think that's going to deliver over time. They're looking at this and saying, over 30 years, this is a reasonable expectation. Right now, if we're pursuing FFP, we're saying we're looking at cash flow generation, we're looking at protection, and we're looking at long-term growth. Let Siegel put a number on that. We have fulfilled the functional responsibilities of this organization.
That's extremely important message, and every system I know of does exactly opposite. Reverse engineer their portfolio and take on more risk to get to their actuarially assumed target, and it's exactly backwards. But I do raise this because the consequence of going with one of these programs will, I'm guessing, necessarily require Siegel to revisit in the next session the assumed rate of return that is a consequent of this asset allocation.
And it could take it to some degree out of the board's hands if we were to continue to use Siegel or an alternative.
Anybody else?
Mr. Chair, I have to step out. So, not for reasons I have a previously scheduled thing, but I support the motion of FFP on constraint.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
On the four-year.
On four.
Four-year.
Four-year unconstrained is the motion.
The 2008 downturn, it had the highest
downside risk.
Rate of return.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to ask Tim, so when I'm back looking at page 16, mm-hmm. and you look at the reallocation of, you know, the way we currently have things allocated, and you look at the way it would reallocate across each of these programs, it would seem to me that our going to the four-year unconstrained you know, we're basically taking everything out of our domestic fixed income programs, right. everything out of our global equity programs, a substantial chunk. I guess we don't really have anything to domestic large cap equity. That doesn't seem right in our current policy.
The global and
it's all versus domestic.
Yeah,
okay,
it's just,
I get it.
It's a reallocation.
Yeah,
right.
So we would be taking, bottom line is we'd be taking a substantial chunk of that center section between international, domestic fixed income, and global equity. And a large portion of that is moving down into what some would consider the riskier real estate, REITs, private equity, and private credit. Isn't this sort of the opposite of what CalPERS is doing?
I'll address CalPERS in a moment. But so the core fixed income, the international fixed income, the high yield, to me, kind of follow the moving dots here, that goes to the short-term government credit up above. So we go through a dramatic restructuring of our fixed income program.
Okay.
We go from a total return core fixed income mandate to a highly specific program intended to throw off monthly cash flows that perfectly meet our benefit payments. So that one gets radically restructured. Then we go through and say, among our growth assets, which includes private equity, public equity, real estate, what's the optimal mix today? Now, implicit in this is, for the growth and diversifying elements, this is the optimal mix today, highly dependent upon current valuations. I think envisioned in this process we would lock down the liquidity portion, and we'd probably come back to you on annual basis with updates on where the best opportunity sets are. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of come to this point of, you've historically had every 3 years we do an asset allocation and we restructure the whole thing to be approximately correct. With this approach, the liquidity provision is set up and operationally probably is not tweaked an awful lot for long periods of time. The growth and diversifying get looked at every year. When Verisk comes out with updated capital market assumptions, we'd have them come in and say, you know, marginally you should think about drawing down this portion and building up this portion.
So a couple notes on that. This is an asset allocation study. We did the asset liability study with you at the ISD. The asset liability study is the more intensive work. It is something we would recommend doing on a three-year basis because the liability profile doesn't change that much. This is much easier to present to you. Our capital market assumptions usually come out the first month or so of the year, so it would be something we'd probably present February or March meeting once we have the numbers.
So we would see this every year?
We could see this every year, exactly.
Okay, I get it.
And I wanted to come back to one earlier point with regards to reverse engineering of the assumed rate. If we take a look at the heat map on page 24, we totally agree with the statements being said here. And so a couple of the key statistics we bring to your attention. Daily VAR and CVAR are two risk metrics. From the risk management world that really look at the dollar exposure on an individual daily basis. What's a 5% chance of something bad happening? How much could we lose in that day? Very convenient for a very short-term view of downside. 2007-09 drawdown simulation. First percentile one-year return, another simulation. So all of those are things that we keep first and foremost in our minds in terms of what's the real downside exposure, and then therefore what's the impact to the enterprise risk, what's the potential impact to the financial sponsor, et cetera, knowing that we could have a 30% drawdown or what have you in these individual strategies.
On page 24, we talk about our actuarial assumptions, but isn't the FFP 4-year 6.6 better than current policy?
Yeah, and that's an important point. Anything on this page is better than current policy. So we're moving in a positive direction.
Right. Okay.
By taking any action today, we're moving in a positive direction. I think the unconstrained ones are intellectually pure. I get a little concerned that it's a lot of moving pieces all at once. So I would probably argue for going into this in a little bit more on the constrained side. It's iterative. We can tweak it along the way. But we can handle the unconstrained. Just understand that's a big project.
Yeah, I'm not supportive of unconstrained person here.
Yeah, I'm not either. I think I would prefer to see us go to a 2-year or 3-year on the FFP, not the unconstrained.
So you like unconstrained. Now, it's not assuming we're
saying constrained.
Saying constrained.
I guess you would call it constrained. It doesn't say that on the page. It just says FFP.
All right. FFP as opposed to the
4-year.
Okay. As opposed to unconstrained FFP.
Yeah, right. That's where I am.
4-year?
No, actually, I would go to 2. I would support 2 or 3-year FFP.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I appreciate all the comments that have been said here, but I've been thinking, our conversations we've had before and where we are as a system and maturing and how we need to be de-risking some. It seems like if we go with the FFP 4 unconstrained, we'd just be taking on more risk in a part of our portfolio.
Yeah, and part of the difficulty here is this models, at least the risk measure you're seeing, how bad could things get. It doesn't model how can you respond to that. Implicit in FFP is we can respond more nimbly because we have liquidity over here. But understanding, the drawdowns would be bigger. I believe we could respond more efficiently, but there would be a bigger drawdown to work off of there.
Yeah, that's kind of the optionality of cash that isn't picked up in this kind of modeling. There is an optionality to it.
I'm not trying to convince anybody, and I understand that these are inexact colors and whatnot. There's certain limitations to that. But if you look at any of the, for lack of a better expression, the constrained FFPs, we're getting only marginally greater expected return. And we're actually getting a reduction in the chances of meeting it. Those things don't make sense to me.
A reduction in the chances of meeting 7.25.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
because it's
same point.
A lower expected rate of
we're getting a 42% chance now. And again, it's just a plug figure to some degree. Mm-hmm. But with a 4-year constrained model, we get 42%. Of hitting the same bogey.
With less volatility around that.
Or with less volatility, but also a lower return than any of the unconstrained options.
To that point, if one's 6.4, the other's 6.6, you have the chance of the same. How do you explain that?
So this has to do with the volatility. So it's basically saying with the FFPs, the standard straight ones, we're looking at 6.5, 6.6% return, but because the volatility band is lower, the odds of us getting to a nice higher return is lower. So today we're at a lower expected return with a higher volatility. Maybe.
Right.
I could probably draw this better than my hands.
There's a whiteboard behind you.
But it's that volatility component that is actually beneficial in creating that probability of exceeding.
And could you talk for a moment about the daily bar and daily C bar? And because you have millions of dollars written on those columns or on those rows, is that the daily fluctuation?
It is. So that's, again, taking into account where we expect the return to be and the volatility around that return. Given that the volatility follows sort of a normal bell-shaped kind of curve, if you go on the downside of that, down to the 95th percentile, that's what the bar is. You have a 5% chance of having that bad of a day. But that's only part of the story, because when you have a day that's that bad, you don't know how bad it could be. It could be at least that bad or worse. And that's what CVAR tries to capture, is saying, okay, well, it's conditional. C is conditional bar. So not only could it be that bad of a day, but really you should probably expect it to be this bad of a day. So when we take a look at policy, there's a 1 in 5 chance we could lose $68 million on any individual day, given the way the portfolio is currently constructed. And when that happens, we should probably expect to lose about $8 million, 1 out of 20 days.
Okay. I want to make a point on the 3-year, 4-year, 2-year thing. The last fall was 2007-08, and we really didn't, in my mind, come back until probably the end of 10. So to me, it's like at least a three-year period. And, you know, four-year would make it more comfortable.
Yeah.
So in my philosophy, about 3 or 4 years, whether it's unrestrained or restrained, it's still, for me, I would like 4 year, could accept 3 year. That's kind of where I'm at, and that's why my reasoning for that.
Deborah, what's your logic for the 2 to 3? Or the reason?
Pardon me?
I'm talking for Deborah. I wanted Deborah.
Yeah. So I think the only, you know, if you just kind of look at the heat map, the only red thing you see on any of these FFP columns is the chance of meeting 7.25%. And I think what that means is you know, if we're gonna go to the unconstrained FFP simply by virtue of that line, getting more volatility, more risk, to chase 7.25%, I don't think that that's the way we should be considering this.
Right.
So I believe, you know, you look at the daily VAR in the FFP 2 and 3, I mean, I guess you can get there by doing the four-year reserves, but even getting into the daily CVAR, I just think you're in a better place without the constrained columns. And then when you get to, you know, some type of a drawdown like we saw in 2007, 2009 through 9, that, you know, we see a substantial difference. In fact, it's the four-year FFP constraint is even a higher negative percentage than our current policy.
But, and if I might, Jerry, just because I want you to have the right, you know, a perfect, the clear picture of 07, 09 crisis. I believe the peak was July 2007. Mm-hmm. The bottom was March 2009. So it was actually about 21 months there. It was less than 2 years. And then we were into recovery mode.
Yeah, the recovery, though. But I'm also including in this the recovery.
Well, remember that we're here to protect against the downside. Once we're in recovery, we're going to want to be buying risk assets now that they're inexpensive.
When we're down.
So it's those turns in the market that we're trying to account for.
Which is an advantage of going on 4 year. Which would be an advantage if you went with the 4 year.
Yeah. Potentially, but the 3 years would more than cover it as well.
So I'll ask you, do you feel more comfortable with the unrestrained or the restraint 4 year with the market doing it and as you explained it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm back on the number of months before I get to the constrained versus unconstrained.
Okay, so
what's your comfort level?
My comfort level is at the three-year number. The four-year provides more flexibility.
Okay.
But the three-year provides everything I think we need.
All right.
And constrained or unconstrained, three.
So where are you?
Hey. I am very much risk-averse and a mature plan. So that would probably lead me to the constrained, at least as a first step.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Test
that.
It for a couple of years.
Right. 3 years.
And then we can take a look at dropping some of the constraints.
A question for Scott. Now,
all right. I'm going to make an alternative motion.
I'm going to withdraw my motion.
I was about to.
I was about to withdraw my second, but I should start with
I'll make an alternative motion.
That there's no motion now.
There's no motion now.
All right.
No,
I'll make a new motion. Right. That we adopt the FFP 3 year. And the restraint.
Constrained. Okay, is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. Clarification.
Yes.
The difference between the ISD FFP and the 2 years, or 3 years, excuse me, is what? How many months?
Number of months was, what'd you say?
So we went from 15% of the workshop to 12% for 2 years. So.
It falls in between the 2 and 3.
I do have a conservative side, by the way.
What other significant factors are there between the two that are different?
I believe we went through and fine-tuned where the growth exposures would come from and where the diversifying exposures would come from. So at the workshop, it was kind of get the big functional differences positioned, and then the board gave Varys the homework to go back and fine-tune it, and
well,
I mean, Ed, you can talk about that.
The key difference was that illiquid assets, so So at the ISD, we had a model portfolio that had about 40% in illiquids. We looked at that and said, that feels like a lot. Can we do that with less? So the FFP constraint, or piece rate, is more in the 30% range.
Gotcha. And the cash, yeah.
So I would like to know, aside from, we've asked Tim his opinion. Mm-hmm. What is your opinion on this? What do you think Veris's comfort level is?
Okay.
Is it the same as Tim's? or is it just...
If you were me, good question, Deborah.
Cut to a commercial break.
So if we take a look at the heat map...
Colors don't matter.
I could see this... Let me answer this in a couple parts. First, I would not...
Pretend you're an attorney.
No
on the one hand,
I would not have been surprised to see the board come out with FFP 4-year unconstrained,
right.
Simply because it offers the highest return potential with essentially the same risk profile. And as we go through the exercise on the risk that the plan sponsor can have and everything, mm-hmm. we're kind of okay with where we are today. We don't feel like we need to dial that down. It's a healthy sponsor. Things are good here. We're heading in the right direction. If we can get that incremental return and we have a 4-year cushion with the cash that allows us to weather a storm, allows us to buy on asset dip, and et cetera, we can do that. There, it's that is a dominant portfolio to where we are today here. As implementation comes into consideration, which is a key consideration, this will take time to build this portfolio and get there over time. Unconstrained might be somewhere where we get to in the future, but probably not what we can do within the course of the next 12 months. And then the course of the next 12 months, we probably bring back to you in a revised study like this. So as far as getting there with an incremental step, that led me to the constrained solution. And then between 3 and 4 years, I think you're in a good situation. I think through the 2007 to 2008 timeframe, there was a false bottom at the end of 2007. That felt really good, and it was right around Obama getting elected, and the markets rallied going into the end of the year. Everything's going to be great, only to fall apart in January, February, and March, and then we put in the bottom. So one of these ideas is that we're going to buy low. We still won't have a crystal ball then,
no.
So we're going to be making an informed decision, but we could very well be wrong. And so if we make that informed decision, and we still have a nice cash cushion, so maybe 4 comes down to 3 kind of thing, or 3 comes down to 2,
yeah.
We're in a pretty good situation to weather it out, but we could still be wrong, and we want to buy again. So we're in a good situation.
And that's an important point, because we still need to resolve what is your minimum level, because we're drawing down. We're not going to constantly have, if we pick 3, we're not constantly going to have 36 months.
Right.
We're going to establish something. It'll be drawn down.
Yeah.
Then we'll come, you know, what we envision is we at the staff level in conjunction with Veris coming back to you once a year and saying, this is our vision for the next year. We think we should rebuild the reserves using the prepayment or by selling equities or something of that nature. We're going to take a look at the markets here. We're going to have the conversation about what the world looks like from this point forward and give a recommendation and then rebuild it. So there'll be a rebuild, drawdown on an annual basis. And we, you know, implicit in this is if we have 36 months, we could use all 36 months. Realistically, the board's not going to be comfortable drawing down to 0. I mean, that's, we're going to have to say, is it 6 months below that mark? Is it 12 months below that mark? Is it 18 months below that mark? And have that conversation. And I think what we want to do would be establish a normal operating range and then probably have some triggers that would say, in an extraordinary market environment, we come back to the board and have a conversation about violating that normal operating range.
So in a year or two, would we revisit and say, I think we need to go to 4-year, or we stay where we're at kind of thing?
I think we would normally, the way I would see this would be we would give this time to prove itself or to prove its challenges, and that would probably be a minimum of 3 years. And then go back and revisit the liquidity buffer. The growth and the diversifying elements, because those are markets in motion all the time, that will be an annual exercise. But in terms of the size of the liquidity provisions, I would let that run for a couple of years, come back to the board and say, this has been our experience. Do you still feel comfortable with this? Do you want to expand or shrink it? But that one is probably, it needs some time to test it.
It sounds like we're kind of between 3 and 4 years.
lean towards 3 right now.
I think the motion is 3, right?
Three.
So Harvey, I would ask you the same question. Are you, is there something that would some advice that you would have for us in terms of this motion, whether it's one way or the other?
No, I think from a fiduciary standpoint that you've considered all aspects of it, and they all, you know, within these ranges, mm-hmm. that this is an extremely prudent approach to go forward on. The only comment I would make is it, recognizing it take time to implement. If the liquidity position is going to be used not only as a protection against the downside, but also as an opportunistic available liquid funds, I'm not a 10th board member, but I would probably err towards the 4-year. Yeah. Than the 3-year in that regard, because I don't want the exception to eat the purpose that we're going through this process. The purpose we're going through it is to protect, is to have liquidity to protect what we need. But if we're also going to have that available for opportunistic investing purposes, I'd still would like to see you have that protection available that you're comfortable with. So that would make me think that having a parking designating a 4-year capacity to serve both of those purposes, mm-hmm. tells me that we have at least 2 for the protection and 2 to use for opportunistic.
And you'll see events. That, you know, as we've moved out from 2 to 3 to 4, we've dropped the diversifying role because some of that diversifying role is fulfilled by the liquidity provision there. So,
page 24 shows 3 and 4 be essentially identical across each dimension. The differences in the numbers are rounding error, and the key difference being 3 versus 4 is a pretty big difference. So I think that supports Harvey's point, is that that extra cushion is the really key differentiator there without getting up the outside.
Tim is saying the opportunistic amount is going to be the same between 3 and 4, right?
You said earlier that the opportunistic amount you would go with between 3 and 4 would be the same. It wouldn't change. So really it's just the... No, you said earlier, you said you wouldn't, on a down market, you wouldn't invest anymore between 3 or 4 year. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Well, I mean, we've got 3 big moving pieces here. Really, you know, 2 big moving pieces and then the second part is split in 2. So we've got the liquidity provision to pay the benefits. Everything else is for long-term growth. Now, within that long-term growth, we know we're never going to be as smart as we think we are, so we need to have some diversifying elements. Some things, they just behave differently than broad economic growth. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we have sized this diversifying, which is modeled out as treasuries and risk diversifying strategies here. And you'll see, I mean, I'm looking on slide 16 here. When you look at, and I'll just focus on the constrained version for the sake of simplicity. If there's 2 years of liquidity reserves, that is working as liquidity reserves. There's not a lot of extra firepower embedded in that, and therefore there's more in the diversifying element because that is where the source of liquidity has to come from, mm-hmm. to buy mispriced assets in an equity downturn. As we move out to the 3 and 4, you'll see that diversifying element kind of scales down because some of that diversifying element can be, not necessarily would be, but could be fulfilled by the liquidity provision.
Okay.
And this will come down to, as we draft the policy statement, when we talk about ranges and minimums, that's kind of where this all can be manifested.
The other concern as far as an implementation here, well, initially, when I first read the material, I was looking at a 2-year unconstrained. And Scott jumped a couple more than I wanted to go. I can see the theory, though. I like the 4-year unconstrained because it gives us that buffer. But the other concern that I have is the implementation, is that we're setting aside the liquid assets immediately, but in order, it's going to take an additional amount of time to invest the growth assets in the private equity, the real estate, and whatever. I mean, we've never hit our allocation on alternatives.
no matter how hard we try.
Right, but our overall growth allocation will remain, it'll just be more heavily tilted towards public markets in the earlier years of this.
So, I mean, if you're looking at this allocation in the abstract, it makes sense, mm-hmm. but it's getting to that that nth degree to fulfill that allocation.
Getting to 17% private equity requires a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, I like the unconstrained because we can tweak it however we want. I mean, it gives us, we can set any sort of optimization or limits on any of these and not let the model run wild. I mean, over the years I've heard, you go to a hedge fund conference and if you let their model run wild, you have 150% in hedge funds. But so, you have to kind of temper this, and these numbers are these particular percentages of allocations are just kind of things that they're fluid, and they could be. So, I think initially, with that concern of the time it's going to take to implement the other end of the barbell on this, I mean, I like the 3-year unconstrained. It gives us a little more flexibility in there. I wouldn't have a problem going to the 4-year unconstrained. I don't want to necessarily be locked into this initially lower expected return of the constrained and have that additional headwind of having to implement the more risky assets or strategies. Although we have the same thing with the unconstrained, but I think within that we can still get to where we want to go or closer to where we want to go within that asset mix as we build out that less liquid area or strategy of the portfolio. So I'd actually be supportive of the more I thought about it, I'd be supportive of Scott's initial motion of the 4-year unconstrained. I have total confidence in our in-house staff and total confidence in our outside consultant with regards to this. I like the idea of the 4-year, and we could always tweak the 4-year because it is expensive getting in and out of selling asset classes to raise money. So if we were going to go to a 2 and then thinking, well, maybe we want to go to a 3, that's more expense as far as selling the different securities. Whereas if we go to a 4, it's much easier to invest liquid securities than to sell growth securities to invest that money in liquid securities to give it a longer window. So I'm kind of torn, but I do like the initial 4-year unconstrained that the number that I always kind of look at is that Sharpe ratio. Is mm-hmm. if we're investing and if we're taking a unit of risk, how much are we expecting to get back from accepting that unit of risk? Yep. And so the Sharpe ratio is always kind of like my bottom line on looking at something and making a decision: is this worth doing in making a comparison?
Well, Scott, you said constrained.
No.
Unconstrained.
The motion on the table is, I believe, 3-year constraint.
Correct.
The
3-year constraint.
First, did the maker of the motion and the seconder have any desire to change that? Otherwise, we might go ahead and vote to see what the...
And if I could just respond to Brian's comment. You're right in that I think the way we would approach this, whatever asset mix the board chooses, we would take the first quarter and figure out what additional resources we need, then issue an RFP to find the liquidity provider, because that is going to be a highly customized strategy. So that money gets moved first. The core fixed income moves over to this highly customized strategy. Now, to the extent we're building into illiquid assets, it's going to take years.
Yeah.
So to get to a four-year unconstrained, understanding we are building into that probably over 6 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long term. The other ones, we probably we'll start on the path. We probably get to the goal a little bit quicker there.
Sure.
Just a consideration.
Then yeah, we could always revisit it.
Call for the question.
But again, the sooner we start down a long path, the sooner we get there, if that's going to be the most effective.
That's more a philosophical comment. I mean, I withdrew my second of Scott's motion. I'm still comfortable with that, but I could support the other one. But we've gone through this path, and I think, not speaking for the entire board, but the board seems to have moved to an area where they're comfortable in sticking their nose out here. And, you know, it's kind of like being taught over the past year how to swim. You've taught us how to become, or convinced us that we can become long-distance swimmers, and now we're going to jump in the ocean and not take our floaties off. So I'm hopeful that we can consider taking those floaties off later on if this motion is passed.
Given his timing, I'd like to try and deal with the motion on the floor. And then if it does not pass, then we can determine whether or not another motion appears. So if we can go ahead and take a vote on the motion on the floor, 3 years constrained, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, we've got three votes.
Jeff had a comment there.
Tell us, Alan.
Just a quick comment. As we've been discussing the unconstrained versus constrained, you know, we want to make sure that we view this as the target. You know, that the unconstrained is a target out there in the future, that to get there, we may actually move through the constrained version as it is. To say that if we are going to build into a long-term private equity, we're going to earmark those assets as we look for providers for that. So while we might say the unconstrained is a little scarier on the risk side, you are taking more liquid, the process of getting there more than likely takes you through the constrained flavors for a period of time as well. So this exercise is really picking the target and deciding how, you know, what do we want to start working towards, but actually the implementation process is going to be iterative and we'll be coming back every year.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll restart with all those in favor. Okay, three votes. All those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Motion fails. Is there a second motion?
I'll move that we, well, I'll let Scott remake his original motion if that's his piece.
It's on you now.
Take my floaties off. I'll move the asset allocation strategy based on the four-year unconstrained.
FFP.
Second.
I'll resecond.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. What's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Opposed? Okay, looks like three.
Who
we missing one? I'm sorry, Rusty,
Alan
four.
And Rodriguez.
So the ayes have it. Okay. We need to deal with anything else?
This afternoon?
Yeah.
We'll be done by New Year's.
January, could you give us an update? Market's closed, unfortunately.
Not everywhere.
After hours trading.
All right.
After